On April 20th, 1980, 14-year-old Loreen Ron was excited to have the apartment to herself. Her mother Judith was going out with her boyfriend, and Loreen asked to stay home. The young woman decided to invite a few friends over and spend the night laughing and joking around. At some point, alcohol got involved, and the three drank and watched TV, kicking off their spring break with a fun evening. When Judith arrived home sometime after midnight, she found the apartment building completely dark. The door to the apartment she shared with her daughter was unlocked, and the back door was not only unlocked, but open. When she checked in the bedroom, she found who she thought was Loreen, but as it turned out, it was Loreen's friend asleep in her bed. After quickly searching the apartment, it was discovered that Loreen was missing and no one had seen her since earlier in the night. Police launched an investigation, though they considered it likely that the 14-year-old had run away. It wasn't until weeks passed that they changed their theory to probable foul play. Over the course of the next few years, there would be sightings, bizarre phone calls, and confusing links made between Loreen, a teen hotline, a doctor, and a porn star. Years later, some will begin to piece together the puzzle, which may suggest that Loreen was one of several women abducted from the same area. What became of Loreen Ron? Why has there been so little coverage? And how is it that nearly 40 years later, the truth remains concealed? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 79, The Disappearance of Loreen Ron. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the mysterious disappearance of 14-year-old Loreen Ron. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, on Instagram at TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today we examine the mysterious disappearance of 14-year-old Loreen Ron from Manchester, New Hampshire. It's a very disturbing case, and one that's always haunted me. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of information available, but what information there is disturbing. This is episode 79, The Disappearance of Loreen Ron. Loreen Ann Ron was born on April 3rd, 1966 to her mother Judith. With details regarding the bulk of Loreen's case being scarce, there isn't a great deal of information about her childhood either. Information regarding Loreen's biological father is unavailable, and there have been articles which suggest that Loreen had a sister, though again, these are details which are not publicly available. What we do know is that the brown-haired, blue-eyed Loreen was doted on by her mother Judith, and that the two would end up living together in an apartment in Manchester, New Hampshire. Manchester is a city located in southern New Hampshire and is the most populous city in northern New England, boasting a population of more than 100,000 residents. Northern New England is made up of New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont, thus making Manchester the city of the tri-state area. Manchester makes up one half of the seat of Hillsborough County and is situated along the Merrimack River, which runs from Massachusetts west and then north into Maine. Loreen and Judith lived in an apartment on the third floor of a building located on Merrimack Street. By all accounts, Loreen was a kind and sweet child who had big dreams. From a young age, she would sing and dance and was drawn to acting, and often fantasized about the possibility of making it big in Hollywood. She was bright and sharp, making good grades throughout her time in school, and she rarely found herself in trouble. The relationship between Laureen and Judith was close, with the mother and daughter spending a lot of time alone together in their apartment. Judith was active on the dating scene, with no father in the picture. From what could be gathered, it seems that, for the most part, Judith found herself in a series of short-lived relationships as Laureen grew up. Laureen was involved with Judith's boyfriends, at least in terms of accompanying her mother on trips and outings with her suitors. Judith was active in ensuring that Laureen was always the most important part of her life, and while men may come and go, her daughter was the light of her life. It was important to her that Laureen felt comfortable and welcome regardless of what the situation was, and she certainly wouldn't hesitate to cut ties with anyone who put Laureen in a place she didn't want to be. Laureen would go on to attend Parkside Junior High School, where she continued to maintain good grades, though little glimmers of teenage rebellion began to show through. It was never anything major, and Laureen was by no means a troublemaker, but she found herself in hot water a few times, as most teenagers will. Interestingly, in an online posting discussing Laureen's case, a woman who claimed to have gone to school with her made note of a school change. According to this poster, Laureen had begun mentioning to friends that she was planning to move out of state, to Florida to be precise, and that one day Laureen was gone from Parkside Junior High. This same poster would later claim to have discovered that, a year later, Laureen had not moved out of state and was instead attending Southside Junior High, which she described as being outside of the school district. However, according to my research, Parkside Junior High was located approximately 2 miles to the west of the apartment, while Southside Junior High was just 2.4 miles to the southeast. Why the change was made, if indeed it was, is unknown, though it's not a dramatic shift in distances as was described. According to Laureen's friends, the now 14-year-old did find herself engaged in some activities that a parent wouldn't approve of. There's been a long-standing rumor that a man, working at a corner store in town, had an affinity towards younger girls and didn't have any qualms about selling alcohol to minors. This, of course, wasn't all that rare in 1980. In fact, the legal drinking age in the United States wasn't changed to 21 until 4 years later, though selling alcohol to a 14-year-old when 18 is the legal age is still unacceptable. Either way, it was never stated that Laureen drank to excess or even drank often, but that on occasion she and some friends would have a drink. From what can be gathered, Laureen never got into any major trouble, and we can't even say for sure whether or not Judith was aware of her daughter's antics, but are they really all that different from any teenager out there today? While alcohol didn't play a major role in Laureen's life, on the night of her disappearance, it would certainly be involved. Judith began seeing a new man, and things were going well. He was involved in tennis, and many papers have reported over the years that he played professionally, though apparently never making it to a level which would grant any gravitas to his name, which has never been mentioned. According to Judith, it wasn't uncommon for she and her then-boyfriend to travel long distances to attend tournaments, and Laureen always came along. It was nice to get away, to take a trip together, and to attend a tennis event. However, on the day of April 20th, 1980, Judith was set to attend another tournament with her boyfriend. Laureen, in this instance, asked if she could stay home by herself instead. It was a Sunday afternoon and Laureen's spring break was set to begin. The teenager wanted a little freedom to stay home and look after herself. Judith initially was hesitant, but eventually agreed since she'd be returning late that night anyway. Laureen was ecstatic and thanked Judith profusely. It was a nice day in Manchester, the temperature hitting a high of 75 degrees, though as the sun settled down, things would change with a low of 37 degrees, a typically bipolar spring day in New England. Judith said goodbye to Laureen, explaining that she'd return late that evening and that Laureen should be asleep by the time she got home. After telling Laureen that she loved her and to be good, Judith left with her boyfriend, never knowing that this would be the last time she'd ever see her daughter. She could never fathom that, upon her return to the apartment, she would find a nightmare of haunting questions waiting for her. Details about the evening vary, depending who you ask. According to a friend of Laureen's who was present at the apartment that night, Laureen had invited her and a male friend over. The plan was, having the apartment all to themselves, they'd have a couple of drinks, sit down in front of the television, joke around, and just have a good time. They had to be careful, as they weren't sure what time Judith would be returning home, but Laureen was pretty sure they'd be done with their little party by then. It was nothing extravagant, just three friends drinking and laughing. There have been, however, rumors over the years that there may have been another person present that evening, a second male, but Laureen's female friend, when later questioned, denied this possibility. Judith, though, has made statements in the past that she believes the story the authorities were given about the events of that night did not contain all of the details. Judith returned home sometime between midnight and 1:30 a.m. The exact time isn't known for certain, though we do know that it was not earlier than midnight. According to Judith, she arrived back at the apartment to find what can only be described as an eerily strange situation. As she stepped into the apartment building, she found that all of the hall lights, which would typically burn all night long, were not on. The first floor was completely dark. Making her way through the darkness, Judith began to make her way up towards their third floor apartment. As she entered the second floor, again, she was disturbed to find not a single light bulb functioning in that hallway. When arriving on the darkened third floor, Judith couldn't help but find the situation creepy, although she did consider the possibility that there may have been a blown fuse or power outage. It wouldn't be until later that she'd learn the truth. As she approached her apartment door, she was surprised to find it unlocked. She had told Laureen to make sure she locked the door, but she imagined her teenage daughter had simply forgotten. Stepping into the apartment, nothing seemed out of place. She locked the door behind her and made her way towards the back door of the apartment to ensure that it was locked. To her surprise, she found the door unlocked and open, not completely, but slightly ajar. Again, to Judith, this was incredibly bizarre, and after she shut and locked the back door, her next move was towards Laureen's bedroom. I should note before going any further that there is some conflict here with timelines and events, and so I'm going to give you as many sides to the details as exist. In multiple reports, Judith opened the door to Laureen's bedroom and clearly saw the shape of her daughter sleeping in her bed. Reportedly, at this time, she quietly shut the door behind her and made note to herself to discuss the unlocked doors with Laureen in the morning. When Judith walked into the apartment's living room, she found a blanket and pillow on the couch, as though perhaps Laureen had been lying on it earlier. In the corner of the room was a pair of brand new shoes that Laureen had just gotten, which was a little strange as Laureen wasn't really in the habit of leaving her shoes lying around. This is where some discrepancies come in. According to the Charlie Project's page on this case, Judith retired to her bedroom, went to sleep, and it wasn't until the morning when she entered Laureen's bedroom that she discovered it was not Laureen asleep in her bed, but instead, her friend who had come over the night before. According to this angle of the story, Judith immediately asked this friend where Laureen was, and the friend replied that while the two had fallen asleep together in the bed, at some point, Laureen woke up, took a pillow and blanket, and told her friend that she could have the bed because she was going to sleep on the couch. Having already seen the blanket and pillow, but no sign of Laureen, it's been said that both she and Laureen's friend simultaneously came to the realization that Laureen was missing. Of course, if Judith did go to sleep that night and not notice Laureen missing until the morning, it would contradict official police reports. The other version of this story, and probably the more likely, is that after seeing who she believed was her daughter asleep in bed, Judith went about her nightly routine but never actually went to sleep. Instead, whether it was due to a mother's intuition or by some other cause, Judith once again entered Laureen's bedroom, this time with the intention of waking her. It's at this time that Judith discovers the friend in her daughter's bed and realizes that Laureen is missing. If you couple Laureen not being in the apartment with all the darkened hallways, it truly does set a frightening scene. According to official police reports, Judith Ron's 911 call came in at approximately 3:45 a.m. Judith was lost and explained to police about the night's events. When officers responded, there wasn't exactly a rush towards concern. In fact, investigators' first response to the report was that Loreen had likely run away and would return. However, they did take a report and spoke with Judith and Loreen's friend. Upon speaking to Loreen's friend and gathering information about the night, they felt more so that this may have been a runaway situation. According to the friend, she, Loreen, and a male friend had drank alcohol, including some wine, laughed and had fun together, and then the male had left before she and Loreen got tired and laid down in the bedroom. It was considered a possibility that there may have been some kind of a dispute over the boy, and that Loreen may have left, but there wasn't any evidence to support this, just investigators trying to put the pieces together based on what little information they had. It was sometime during the initial interviewing stage that investigators made a disturbing discovery. As it turned out, there hadn't been a power outage or a blown fuse. In fact, the electricity in the apartment building was functioning perfectly. Someone had gone and physically twisted the light bulbs in every fixture in all of the hallways on every floor of the building, just enough for the light to go out. While this was viewed as a major indicator that something was wrong here, police again maintained their belief that Loreen had run off and would likely return. Despite their perspective on the case, police did follow up on events from that evening and managed to track down the male friend who had been in the apartment. According to authorities, this male was never considered a person of interest, and his story closely matched that of Loreen's female friend. The male stated that he had come to the apartment at Loreen's invitation, had been drinking with the two young women, and at some point during the evening, he couldn't recall the exact time, the trio had heard voices in the hallway outside of the apartment. Assuming that this must have been Judith returning home and not wanting to get caught drinking with two underage young women, the male said that Loreen took him to the back door of the apartment to sneak out. The male claimed to have not only witnessed Loreen shutting the door behind him, but also specifically added in that he heard Loreen locking the door behind him. This detail has been a source of controversy, as Judith found the back door not only unlocked, but partially open when she returned home. I should note, there's basically no information available about this male friend, judging from the fact that he didn't want to be caught drinking with two underage females. It may be possible to assume that he was 18 years or older. Either way, he was old enough to think he'd get in trouble if he was found drinking with minors, and there's also the high probability that this older male friend may have been the one who provided the alcohol. Again, we can't know these details for certain at this time, though I'd love to find out. Regardless, authorities did not believe the male friend played a role in Loreen's disappearance. They believed the 14-year-old had run off. But the more they investigated, the more the details seemed to make this unlikely. First, there was the situation with the light bulbs that no police officer considered a coincidence. It was debated whether or not this had been done to obscure the activities of an abductor who didn't want to be seen by a witness, or perhaps if this had been done in order to conceal someone's identity so they could knock on Loreen's door and grab her. Of course, if it revolved entirely around abducting Loreen, why then were the light bulbs turned off on every floor instead of just hers? These are questions that no suitable answers could be found for. Other details which contradicted the idea of a runaway were that Loreen had taken nothing with her. Her purse and all of her clothing had been left behind, and it was considered unlikely that a teenage girl would run away from home with nothing, not even her wallet. The more time passed, the more authorities began to doubt their initial theory. They believed that had Loreen run away, she'd have returned or called or someone would have seen her by now, but they had nothing. There were no sightings, and despite coverage on local media and in the papers displaying photos of Loreen, many people called who knew the young woman, but none who had seen her since April 20th. Within a few weeks of Loreen's disappearance and with no leads or information to work with, investigators were growing frustrated. While some clung to the runaway theory, others were questioning things, and as that number of officers increased, the police officially changed their stance on the events of that night. Now, rather than arguing that Loreen had run away, they had a different possibility. Investigators believe that Laureen had left the apartment building that night and likely encountered foul play somewhere along the way. Whether or not Laureen left alone, or perhaps in response to someone knocking on the door, they couldn't say for sure, but they did believe that whatever happened to the young woman took place outside of the building. The absence of any kind of a struggle, no reports of shouting or arguing, and no physical evidence seemed to support this hypothesis. Unfortunately, there was nothing to work with. Details of the investigation remain obscured. Whether or not the apartment or the light bulbs had been dusted for prints is unknown, though apparently if this was done, it led nowhere. When Laureen's friends were spoken to in subsequent interviews, their stories again remain the same. Neither had any reports of anyone coming by the apartment, no strange behaviors, no phone calls, nothing which would indicate any problem. The disappearance of Laureen Ron began to fade from the media. In fact, it began to fade from everywhere. As quickly as the 14-year-old had vanished into the night, even her name was beginning to disappear. The number of officers assigned was reduced due to lack of anywhere to go with it, and for the town of Manchester, Laureen's fate became a cautionary tale. It wouldn't be until 6 months after her daughter disappeared that Judith would make a bizarre discovery. In October of 1980, less than 6 months after Laureen had disappeared, Judith found strange charges on her phone bill. According to the bill, 3 calls had been charged to her account. All 3 of the calls had been placed from a hotel in Santa Monica, California, and all 3 had been made approximately 3 months after Laureen had vanished, placing them sometime in July. Back in 1980, before the prevalence of cell phones and changes to the way telephone operation worked, a caller had the option to call someone long distance or to charge that call to their own bill. This would mean that whoever made the calls from that hotel had used Judith's phone number, either completely at random or perhaps on purpose. This made Judith wonder if it was possible that the calls had been made by her daughter. What was strange about it was that there was no connection for Judith in California, no family or friends out there. She, and in turn Laureen, knew no one who lived on the West Coast. These phone calls were tracked down as best they could be. 2 of the calls had been made to a hotel in Santa Ana, California, and there wasn't really anywhere to go with them beyond that. The 3rd call, however, had been made to a teen sexual assistance hotline. This hotline, upon further investigation, tracked back to a physician living in California. Police did reach out to the doctor and speak with him in regards to the hotline and about Laureen's disappearance, though at the time, he denied any knowledge of not only Laureen, but the hotline itself. At this time, it appeared, law enforcement moved on from the doctor, having nothing solid to link him to Laureen's disappearance. But he will be revisited a few years later, and he'll tell a very different story. Outside of the 3 phone calls charged to Judith's account, there were more creepy phone calls connected to this case. According to Judith and her sister, over the course of the next few years, they each received a large number of anonymous calls. These calls typically came in around 3:45 a.m., the same time that Judith had called the police to report Laureen missing. According to both women, when answered, the other end of the line was always silent, as though someone called but was just listening, never speaking. The calls happened randomly, typically in the early morning hours, except around Christmas. During the holiday season, the calls grew in frequency, and Judith began to wonder if it was possible that it was Laureen calling. However, due to the absence of a voice or a response on the other end, Judith would eventually change her phone number to avoid these disturbing late-night calls. In 1981, a year after Laureen had vanished, a family member thought she may have seen her. According to this family member, a young woman who closely resembled Laureen was seen in Boston, Massachusetts, some 60 miles to the south of Manchester. Details regarding this alleged sighting are fairly limited and mentioned only loosely in a few articles. Reportedly, the witness believed the individual may have been Laureen, but the sighting was never confirmed, and by all accounts, there was no interaction between the family member and the woman at the bus terminal. By the time authorities were able to investigate and follow up, the woman was long gone. Over the course of the next few years, Loreen's case grew stagnant. Tips which had once flowed in were few and far between, and none had ever led investigators closer to the truth. It would be 5 years before there was any significant movement on Loreen's case. However, in that year, two incidents would occur which would raise further questions regarding Loreen's possible whereabouts. The first of these took a tragic turn when the young man who had been in Loreen's apartment with her the night she vanished took his own life. Unfortunately, since his name has never been publicly revealed, it's difficult to determine much about the circumstances surrounding his suicide. Whether or not this suicide may have been connected in any way to Loreen's disappearance or not, we may never know. The second of the 1985 incidents took place in California, when authorities once again had need to speak with the doctor to whom the teen sexual assistance hotline had previously been connected. This time, though, when speaking to the physician, he had a very different story to tell. Whether 5 years had loosened things up for him or if he felt more safe somehow, we can't say. But the doctor was much more open about the hotline and about the possibility of Loreen. According to this doctor, it was not uncommon for young runaway girls to come to his home and visit his wife. He also specified that one of the young women who had visited his wife resembled Loreen and claimed to have been from New Hampshire. Now, while this is all very interesting, it should be noted that the details of this so-called teen sexual assistance hotline and the driving force behind young runaways showing up at the doctor's home has never been explained, but the creepiness factor is quite high. In addition to this, the doctor gave police the name of a woman who he suggested might possess information about Loreen's disappearance. Annie Sprinkle, real name Ellen Steinberg, was a prominent adult film star at the time. Since the 1970s, she had made appearances in pornographic movies and made quite a name for herself. According to the doctor, Steinberg was a friend of his wife's, and he believed she could possibly have some knowledge about Loreen, though in what context, he never did go into detail. Authorities reached out to Steinberg, though the woman claimed to have no knowledge of Loreen, let alone any runaways, and police could find absolutely nothing to tie Steinberg to Loreen. It appeared to be yet another dead end in a case that was consistently smashing into brick walls. While Steinberg had been a prominent porn star during the 70s and 80s, she did eventually step away from the camera, obtaining a Bachelor of Fine Arts and later a PhD in human sexuality. Steinberg has worked as a sex educator for years and married her longtime partner, Beth Stevens, in 2007. While Steinberg was alleged to have connections to Loreen, I did think it important to note that in the nearly 40 years since Loreen vanished, Steinberg has never been in trouble with the law. At the time, law enforcement did view several of Steinberg's adult movies looking to see if any women resembled Loreen, but none were found. So, to recap, 5 years after Loreen disappears, a former friend takes his own life, and a strange doctor alleges a connection to a porn star. None of it makes much sense, but it's all that anyone had at the time. Sadly, these are basically two of the largest developments throughout the history of this case, and they lead nowhere. Out of frustration and in great pain over the loss of her daughter, Judith wasn't quite ready to give up. The following year, in 1986, she hired a private investigator to try and track down further information regarding the phone calls charged to her account back in 1980. This private investigator, when speaking to the Santa Monica police, was informed that the hotel from which the calls originated may have been at the center of a pornography ring at the time. Reportedly, an unknown individual identified only as Dr. Z had been operating a child pornography ring at the hotel, and it was one of the places he also filmed some of his pornography. Now, it does seem incredibly coincidental that Loreen Ron may have ties to a doctor who runs a teen sexual assistance hotline, while at the same time phone calls are made in charge to her mother's phone bill from a hotel in which a child pornographer known as Dr. Z operates. And yet authorities have never found any information to link Dr. Z to either Loreen or the hotline, let alone the other doctor to the child pornography or to Dr. Z. But it's really difficult to dismiss the concept that Dr. Z and the other doctor who claimed Laureen might have been with Annie Sprinkle are not the same person. Allegedly, they are not. But again, in a case where you're dealing with a list of people of interest whose names are never revealed, it's difficult to know exactly what anyone was really up to behind the scenes. Later that same year of 1986, a childhood friend of Laureen's received a bizarre phone call. Roger Moraes wasn't home when the phone rang one afternoon, but his mother was. According to her, when she answered the phone, there was a young woman on the other end who identified herself as either Laureen or Lori. According to Miss Moraes, the young woman claimed to have been an ex-girlfriend of her son, Roger. The full context of the call has never been revealed, but allegedly it didn't last very long and the caller terminated the conversation without giving out any more information. Judith and investigators have always wondered whether this call could have been made by Laureen. Judith 100% believes that the three calls charged to her phone in 1980 were made by her daughter. If Judith had changed her number by this time, could this have been Laureen trying to contact anyone she may have known whose number she could still remember? The last reported sighting of Laureen took place in 1988, at which point she would have been 22 years old. A witness in Anchorage, Alaska, contacted authorities when he believed a sex worker operating in the area bore a striking resemblance to Laureen. Concerned about the young woman and aware of her case as seen on a missing persons flyer, the man gave a detailed description to authorities, who did their best to track down the woman but were unable to locate her. Ultimately, this sighting is considered a possibility, and while police were able to investigate the witness enough to believe his story, they could not corroborate whether or not he had actually seen Laureen. For the most part, Laureen's story falls silent following this possible sighting. No new clues or information has been discovered. No sightings of Laureen were reported after that time. Judith eventually remarried and moved out of New Hampshire, heading down to live out the rest of her days in Florida. In regard to Laureen, she's never given up hope that her daughter is still out there. In recent years, Judith has allegedly worked with some psychics to try and track down Laureen's whereabouts. In addition to this, when asked about what she believes happened to her daughter, Judith has been emphatic that the three calls were made by Laureen, and she believes that one of Laureen's childhood friends has more information that she has chosen not to share with authorities. Many years later, authorities and researchers began to examine other disappearances which had taken place in the area that shared similarities to Laureen's in hopes of making a connection. The first name brought up was that of 15-year-old Rachel Elizabeth Garden. Garden disappeared from Newton, New Hampshire, 35 miles southeast of Manchester, on March 22, 1980, just a month prior to Laureen. Garden was last seen walking Maple Avenue with plans of spending the night at a friend's house, but she never arrived. Much like the case of Laureen, investigators initially believed Garden was a runaway. It wasn't until a witness came forward identifying Garden as the young woman he saw speaking to three men in a car on the night she vanished. One of those men had previously served time for assaulting a woman. One of the men later confessed to murdering Rachel and gave investigators the location of her remains, but nothing was ever found and her case remains unsolved. 15-year-old Shirley Ann McBride lived in Manchester, New Hampshire, just 2 miles from Laureen. McBride would relocate to Concord, 17 miles to the north. Moving in with her sister Donna, McBride was frustrated with her parents' rules, which she felt were too strict. At approximately 9:30 p.m. on Friday, July 13, 1984, McBride exited her sister's apartment with the intention of visiting her 21-year-old boyfriend. McBride was never seen again, and while it was initially suggested that she was also a runaway, again, this was a case of a teenage woman disappearing while leaving behind all of her belongings. There have been various sightings of McBride over the years, though nothing has ever been confirmed. Authorities later theorized that the young woman met with foul play, and her boyfriend was considered a person of interest. In 1996, Her parents had McBride declared legally dead, though what truly became of their daughter remains a mystery. The last of these disappearances, and the one which seems to share the closest similarities to Laureen's, is that of Denise Denal. Denal, a 25-year-old mother of two, was living with a roommate on Hayward Street in Manchester, just two blocks away from Laureen's apartment building, in 1980. On Sunday, June 8th, Denal attended a social gathering, leaving at approximately 1:30 a.m. to stop by a different party. Denal, however, never made it to that party and was never seen again. Despite the fact that Denal had vanished just 2 months after Laureen, also on a Sunday during the early morning hours, and lived within close proximity to Laureen, no distinct connections could be made between the two missing women. Some have commented that Laureen and Denal physically resembled one another, and while this is true, no solid evidence has ever connected them. 37 years after Denal's disappearance, a joint effort launched by the FBI and the Manchester Police searched in a wooded area located behind public housing buildings on Kimball Street. Neither the FBI nor the police stated what drove them to search that particular area, but they did employ heavy equipment digging through a large section of earth. The search covered several days, but nothing was found. In later discussions with the media, police did discuss the fact that Denal lived just two doors down from a man known as Bob Evans, but you may know him better as Terry Peter Rasmussen, the man believed to be responsible for the four murder victims discovered in metal drums in Bear Brook State Park, located in Allenstown, New Hampshire. It should be noted, Bear Brook State Park is located just 20 miles north of Manchester. Authorities believe there may be a link between Denal's disappearance and Rasmussen. Three young women, all within 30 miles of one another, inside of a four-year block of time, vanish under mysterious circumstances that, in some way, bear similarities to Laureen Ron. For many, this opens up the possibility that Laureen's abduction may have been connected to a serial predator, while for others, it's a matter of coincidence, with no solid evidence linking any of the women to one another. Is it possible that Laureen met a similar fate at the hands of the same suspect, or are these cases all independent of one another? That's an answer which remains unknown. Laureen Ron's disappearance is a disturbing case for which there's barely any information available. Investigators have stated that the case remains open, though for years now it has languished in the cold case files. There's been nothing discovered, no new information, clues, or tips. For Judith, it remains as painful today as it was back in 1980, when she said goodbye to her daughter for the last time. In the absence of solid evidence, two theories have been suggested as possibilities. The first theory considers the possibility that Laureen may have been abducted and forced into sex work, be that as a sex worker or perhaps operating in child pornography. Many believe that the calls from California, the alleged porn ring associated to Dr. Z, and the teen sexual assistance hotline could have connections to Laureen, who could have been lured out by someone promising her a career in film. The second theory puts forth the possibility that Laureen was abducted and may have been murdered quickly following her disappearance. With other disappearances in the area and the circumstances of her building, with the light bulbs being twisted off and the back door left open, many believe it's possible that a predator may have utilized the darkness to conceal himself, and that he somehow managed to get Laureen to exit her apartment, at which time she was taken. When last seen, Laureen Ron was described as being a Caucasian female with brown hair and blue eyes, standing 5'4" tall, and weighing approximately 90 pounds. Laureen was last seen wearing a white V-neck sweater, a blue plaid blouse, jeans, brown shoes, a heart-shaped gold ring, and a silver and blue necklace. Laureen has a prominent scar on her upper leg. She was last seen in her apartment on Merrimack Street in Manchester, New Hampshire, on April 20th, 1980. If alive today, Laureen would be 53 years old and has been missing for 39 years. As a result, Age-progressed photographs are available and depict Loreen as she may appear today. 39 years is a long time to wait for answers. For Judith, it's been a waking nightmare, wondering what may have become of her daughter. From the phone calls to the sightings, the phone bill, and friends that she believes haven't been completely honest, the situation regarding Loreen's disappearance has haunted her for nearly 40 years. Desperate for answers, she's gone on to consult so-called psychics, who have provided a great many possibilities, but nothing that has ever been proven. What does a mother do when her child has been missing for more than twice as long as she was alive? What kind of life could Loreen have made? Would she be a mother today? An actress? Loreen's future was stolen from her, and Judith's life was forever scarred. Judith believes her daughter was alive, at least for a time after her abduction. She clings to the hope that someday she'll see her face again. For nearly 4 decades, the truth has remained hidden, but perhaps someday the light will finally shine into the darkness, and Loreen's fate will be revealed. The disappearance of Loreen Ron is a case which has always haunted me. I probably first heard about it as a kid, watching Unsolved Mysteries and getting creeped out in the dark. Ever since then, it's always stuck in my head. The older I've gotten, the sadder it's become, and now 39 years since she was last seen, and we still have very little, if anything, to suggest what may have become of her. There's theories, of course, but almost no evidence to support them. While 1980 doesn't seem that far away, for some of us, it was leaps and bounds behind the approach these cases would see today. Sure, we still see disappearances dismissed as runaways, but there's a good chance that if this crime occurred today, there'd be Amber Alerts at a minimum, plus social media to help support the search and others contributing. The absence of information is what makes this case as incredibly difficult to cover as it is, and it's probably the reason why many of you have never heard it. There are very few sources here, and if you noticed, this is a rare episode in which I didn't use a single quote. Well, that's because there's really no quotes to find. As much a mystery as the disappearance itself is, so is almost everything surrounding it. We don't know a great deal about Loreen, but she was 14 years old and had her entire life ahead of her, or so she thought. Just imagine yourself at 14. How naive were you? And what dreams did you have for your future? For many, we grow up and change direction and end up somewhere completely different, but Loreen never had that opportunity. It was taken away from her in a night, and that's incredibly confusing and frustrating. For Judith, her life was forever changed, and she would go on to wonder what became of her beloved daughter. Judith has her thoughts, police have theirs, and independent researchers chip in from time to time, but for the most part, the possibilities, as is related to Loreen's disappearance, tend to fall into two distinct theories. The first theory examines the possibility that Loreen may have been abducted and forced into sex work. Many people believe that Loreen ended up in California. Based on the reports from the unknown doctor and his teen sexual assistance hotline, which, by the way, I still have no idea what exactly that hotline was all about or how it was used. I'm not a huge proponent of coincidences, though they certainly do exist. If there had only been the calls charged to Judith's account from a motel in Santa Monica, I might not give as much credence to them. I mean, let's face it, if someone wanted to charge long-distance calls to a random account, they would just choose a random number. I should explain, I've read 2 ways in which these calls could have been charged to a different account. Under one scenario, a person would contact the phone company and obtain a specific PIN number, which they would then enter, and that number would grant them the ability to charge calls to an account regardless of where they were, but of course, they would have to prove they owned that account. But I've also read about a matter of simply dialing 0, then your home phone number, then the number you wish to call long distance. In that latter version, you wouldn't need a PIN number or any contact with the phone company, and so, essentially, anyone could do this simply by looking through the phone book. Now, what are the chances that this is what happened here? That's hard to say, but you can't rule it out. But it does feel far too coincidental to just be happenstance. But then that does raise the question of why Loreen would have done this if it was her on the phone. Rather than calling home and speaking to her mother or calling the police or calling anyone, she'd charge long-distance calls to her mom's account. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Also, these calls were made to a motel in Santa Ana, but we have no idea who the calls were made to. I suppose guest records from that time weren't kept, and so it's not possible to track down who stayed in the room where those calls were directed. The Santa Monica police, years later, did speak with Judith's private investigator, at which time they discussed the possibility of child pornography. Apparently, around 1980 or so, a man known only as Dr. Z worked in pornography and was involved in a child porn ring, which centered around that motel. So is it possible that by some means, Laureen was abducted and ended up as a part of this? Unfortunately, yes. Child pornography is a huge problem, and with increases in technology, we're seeing both new ways to fight it, but also new ways to spread it. Things were different back then, and child pornography was likely much more under the table and harder to come by. A person would have to know someone involved in it to get their hands on it. That being said, there were many people out there like Dr. Z who used false names, accounts, and paid for everything with cash in order to conceal their illegal operations. How difficult was it really for someone to get their hands on a camera and just start making films? Not as difficult as you'd imagine, and while it's tremendously disgusting and sad, there's a lot of money in those films. So, it's entirely possible that Laureen ended up in California being forced to work for these sick people. In 1985, when police spoke with that unnamed doctor who was alleged to have been connected to the hotline, he had some strange things to say. Firstly, the idea that the runaway women often visited his wife at their personal home was bizarre to me. Were they invited? How did they know where to go? It seems incredibly unlikely that runaways were simply showing up on his doorstep by accident. There must have been some incentive and some guidance as to how to arrive there. Beyond that, the doctor did say one of the girls could have been Laureen. Well, why wait 5 years to come forward with this unless you're either concealing something or making it up? So the doctor directs the police towards Annie Sprinkle, a porn star at the time. There's never been an explanation as to why he suggested this woman might know of Laureen. Perhaps the doctor knew that Laureen had been forced into sex work and pornography and figured that Annie would know her, but it could also have meant that the doctor believed Annie had been around Laureen. That's a possibility. While porn today is more mainstream and the internet has opened the floodgates, it's still a career choice that typically ends in broken lives, and for the most part, society looks down on it. Back in 1980, it was even more so this way, and a lot of people who were involved weren't beyond selling someone out to make a little extra cash. Could Laureen have been a young woman taken under the wing of an older, more experienced porn star who then used her for her own personal benefit? Again, that's a sad possibility. The problem is, we have no connection to Annie Sprinkle. She denied knowing Laureen, she denied ever meeting Laureen, and she denied ever working with an underage young woman. The only thing to connect Sprinkle to Laureen is the word of an unnamed doctor. Kind of strange, isn't it? This so-called doctor gets to keep his anonymity, but the porn star doesn't. Anyway, in the nearly 40 years since Laureen disappeared, Annie Sprinkle has avoided trouble. She hasn't been arrested or accused of anything. She's never been alleged to have any connections to child pornography or any other illegal activities. She turned her life around, acquired degrees, works in sex education, and is involved in a lot of projects and academic arenas. It's all speculative at this time, but we can't know if there's any legitimacy behind the claims of Annie knowing Laureen, or if it was all just made up by this anonymous doctor. Here's a major problem I have with this theory. Is it just me, or is it too coincidental that there's a doctor operating a so-called teen sexual assistance hotline while simultaneously there's a guy running a child pornography ring involving underage girls named Dr. Z and there's no connection here? That's a hell of a coincidence. Over the years, many have surmised that this hotline may have been used as a method by which to groom potential victims. A phone number is provided to answer questions for teens who are struggling to come to terms with their sexuality, and through this hotline, predators would have access to the children whom they could manipulate. Could this have happened to Laureen? Maybe. There's never been any reports of calls to the hotline being made on Judith's phone bill, but that doesn't make it impossible either. The phone calls bother me too. The ones made to Judith and her sister. Sure, anyone could just pick up a phone and make these calls to be creepy, and that's definitely happened in other cases, but usually they just target one person. Why was Judith's sister also receiving calls? That's very strange to me, and while the possibility exists that it could have been Laureen calling, why would she never say anything, even if it was just a single word? It seems more likely that these calls originated from a sick prankster, or perhaps someone who had more information about Laureen's disappearance than he or she was willing to share. When it comes to the California theory, remember, Laureen loved Hollywood. She wanted to be an actress, a famous celebrity. How many young women went to California in search of the glitz and the glam, and instead found themselves on a black leather couch in the seedy section of town? Far too many to count, but the real question here becomes one of how exactly would Laureen have ended up in California in the first place? And that really takes us straight back to the scene of the crime, Merrimack Street, Manchester, New Hampshire. Exact times are absent from the record, but we know that sometime between 8 p.m. and 1:30 a.m., Laureen will go missing. When her mother returns, she finds the front door of the apartment closed but unlocked. The back door is both unlocked and partially open. There's a blanket and a pillow on the couch and one of Laureen's friends in her bed. The friend doesn't know where Laureen is, and the other friend, who had left earlier, an older male, says that when he left, Laureen was fine and locked the door behind him. In what can only be described as an incredibly creepy set of circumstances, someone has taken the time to go up and down every hallway on all three floors of the building, unscrewing light bulbs until they turn off. That's a really bizarre activity, and it's hard to find an answer for. The most obvious thought is that whoever did this did so in order to cover up their crime. They must have done this quietly and somewhat late in the evening. Otherwise, other tenants in the building could have seen them, or at least have experienced walking down the dark hallways. But from the information that we have, there weren't a bunch of neighbors saying that they noticed the lights being out earlier in the evening. It isn't uncommon for this kind of activity to take place. Take a look at the Springfield 3, and you'll see similar behaviors as pertains to light bulbs. So, whoever did this had the foresight to try and conceal their behavior. It's also interesting to note that whoever committed this crime either knew that Judith was not home that night, or just got incredibly lucky in choosing that particular night to abduct Laureen. We don't know much, but police believe Laureen actually left the building of her own choice. Why this would be done as late as it was, we don't know, but some have theorized she may have heard a knock on the door. When she opened it, any number of possibilities exist. A man could have told her he needed help, or told her the power was out and he couldn't get into his apartment, or it could have been someone she knew, though we'll get more into that in the second theory. By some way, shape, or form, Laureen exits the building, and at this point, the predator is able to grab her and disappear, perhaps into a waiting car. After that, anything is possible, including that Laureen could have found herself being moved across the country towards California. It seems a little far-fetched, but stuff like this happens every day. People are abducted and taken across the country and sometimes out of the country and forced into sex work. How many cases have we discussed where human trafficking is a legit possibility? Quite a few, and in this case, that's a possible reality that exists. So when you lay it all down side by side, could someone have abducted Laureen and forced her into sex work and pornography? Yes, it's possible. We have no evidence, outside of some phone calls, to try and make this connection, but it's one which could exist. Typically, when someone is abducted, unless they're being taken for a specific reason, they're not going to survive too long. Laureen may have survived and been put through hell. Laureen could still be out there, under the control of who knows, subjected to the kinds of horrors we dare not imagine. But if Laureen wasn't abducted with the intent to traffic her, then many believe that the other possibility is murder. Of course, there's a lot of questions circulating around this and not many answers. I, like Judith, do believe that the story given to investigators about the exact events of the evening Laureen disappeared are probably not completely accurate. First of all, you're dealing with a frightened young woman who was friends with Laureen. She could have left information out on purpose or by accident. She could have outright lied to protect someone or out of fear. Remember, there were rumors that a fourth person was present and that this was another man. Could he hold the answers to this mystery? There's the guy who we know who definitely was there, but he didn't have much to say about it. He snuck out of the apartment when he thought Judith was coming home. His story matched Laureen's friends and the pertinent details, and so investigators didn't really have much they could do. We know this male friend later took his own life, 5 years later, though I have read that authorities dug into whether or not they thought Laureen's case could have played a role in that suicide, and they ruled it out. But anything is possible. Depression, guilt, a number of things lead people to take their own lives, so unfortunately in this instance, there's very little information that can be gleaned from this incident. Now, it's been nearly 40 years. One would assume that if Laureen's friend had concealed any information at this time, likely being 14 herself at the time, she'd have come forward by now. Unless, of course, she was involved in something for which the statute of limitations hasn't yet run out. Purely speculative, but we've got to consider all the angles. I do think it's highly unlikely that this young woman would have done something to Laureen, and then rather going home and just denying that she was ever there, instead choosing to go sleep in Laureen's bed to be found by her mother. Just doesn't make any sense to me, but I do believe she could possess knowledge that she doesn't even know is valuable. We know from the condition of the apartment that nothing major happened in there. There was no struggle or any evidence to suggest an assault or violent abduction had taken place. This is part of what makes authorities believe that Laureen may have left the building of her own volition. Well, there's a couple of possibilities there. Laureen could have wanted a breath of fresh air. She could have maybe gone out to sneak a cigarette or perhaps to meet back up with the young man who had exited the apartment through the back door. Based on the account of what Laureen was last seen wearing, a sweater, blouse, jeans, shoes, this doesn't sound like a young woman who was focused on going to sleep on the couch right away. So it's definitely possible that Laureen went to meet someone or had some other reason to go outside. Now, if you're like me, you're wondering, would a 14-year-old girl make the trek down several flights of stairs in completely darkened hallways without becoming afraid and going back to her apartment? Maybe, but it seems unlikely. But we're also assuming that she left through the front door. Her friend left through the back and was able to bypass the hallway, and so Laureen could have done the same. Maybe this is why the back door was not only unlocked, but partially open. Laureen could have snuck out back for any number of reasons and found someone waiting for her, whether that someone was there to lure her away through deception or to outright grab her. We established earlier that several other young women vanished from within a 30-mile radius of Laureen's apartment both before and after she disappeared. None of these women has ever been located, and it seems highly unlikely that all of them were forced into sex work, which basically leaves only homicide as an option. Sure, there are other possibilities, but going strictly by the statistics of it all, if it wasn't an abduction, then it was likely a murder. We know about the barrels in Bear Brook, though one would assume that these were checked against Laureen. However, that leaves a vast wealth of other possibilities in that area. Laureen could have been taken anywhere, and if her abduction took place earlier in the evening, by the time Judith called the police, she could have been hours away. So for many, it's a bitter debate. Was Laureen taken by a complete random abductor, or was she lured into a trap by someone she may have known? Remember that guy? He worked at the corner store and had a predilection towards young women and had no issue selling the underage young ladies alcohol? Could this be a person that may have been able to convince Laureen to come outside? We have no way of knowing, but again, anything is possible. This is a case where we simultaneously have both limitless suspects and no suspects. As far as I'm concerned, anyone that knew Laureen and was aware Judith would be out of town that night is a possibility. Sadly, in a case where almost nothing has ever been revealed, where do you even begin to look? Can Laureen's case truly be linked to any of the other disappearances that occurred around that time? It is strange that these women all disappeared, and at least three of them, including Laureen, were 14 or 15 at the time. Then there are those who believe that the older missing woman, 25-year-old Denise Denault, could be connected to the man believed to have been responsible for the Bear Brook murders. Could Laureen have become his victim as well, knowing that he lived only two blocks away? That's certainly a theory that could be looked at more closely, though 40 years later, it's difficult to imagine what evidence could be found, and much like everything else in this case, it is both possible and uncertain. The disappearance of Laureen Ron is frightening, heartbreaking, and frustrating. A 14-year-old girl says goodnight to her friend and disappears into nothing. Not a single trace of anything is ever found. Not a shred of clothing, a footprint, nothing. All we have are phone calls coming in late at night with no one on the other end. A series of long-distance calls from California charged to Judith's account. And the words of an alleged doctor who is running a hotline that, for all intents and purposes, sounds incredibly shady. Could this be a cross-country abduction involving trafficking and forced sex work? Or is it a matter of a young woman getting grabbed off the streets of her hometown and murdered shortly thereafter? Perhaps the truth will yet be found, and Judith might be afforded the ability to discover her daughter's fate before her time is up. Until some new evidence is found, police break the case, or someone confesses. The disappearance of Laureen Ron remains open, unsolved, and extremely cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Laureen Ron, there are a few websites and articles addressing her story, but information is quite limited. If you have any information about the disappearance of Laureen Ron, please contact the Manchester Police Department or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. A special shout out and thank you to Trace Evidence Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Julia Rexon, Kate Alexander, Megan, Randy Weiland, Chandra Moreau, Tara Doble, Megan Cotter, and Tom Archer. Trace Evidence wouldn't be possible without the kindness of all of you amazing listeners. Visit patreon.com/traceevidence for more information. Quick reminder that CrimeCon 2019 in New Orleans is just a few weeks away, and I'll be on Podcast Row, excited to meet all of you. If you haven't yet purchased a pass, use promo code TRACE19 to save 10% today. I'll also be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago in July. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.